Okay, everybody, here we are for week 17 of Now Showing with Mike and Wayne. Wayne and I are here with our good friend Doug Cabrera, avid Halloween horror film fan, and he's going to chime in and have a conversation with us about the Halloween franchise. Doug, thank you for coming on.
Hey, thanks, guys. It's a pleasure. It's awesome to be on here and be able to talk about these fun movies. And before we get going, I just wanted to say that I'm proud of you two guys. I'm pumped for you guys. You guys are doing this. It's been very entertaining. And if anybody knows their stuff when it comes to movies, it's you guys. So hopefully people are enjoying it and getting a good insight on your guys' knowledge on all these movies you guys talk about, because you guys are animals when it comes to movies, to be honest with you. So it's a good thing.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate the kind words.
For those of you guys that don't know Doug or don't know us really well, Doug has been a mentor to both me and Mike throughout our professional working careers. So it's truly an honor to have him joining us today and just to chat a little bit about some classic horror movies and some other surprises and stuff we got coming up this episode. So again, thanks for being here, Doug. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Thank you.
All right. So let's get the show rolling. We are going to talk about one of my favorite movies of all time, and definitely my favorite horror movie of all time to start this off, and it's Halloween 1978, directed by the great John Carpenter, starring Scream Queen Jamie Lee Curtis, veteran character actor Donald Pleasance, and it's just easily one of the coolest sounding and looking movies I think that's come out. It's definitely an indie film from back in the day because they didn't have a huge budget. Even though there weren't really indie film studios back then. So this movie, the first time I saw it was probably, I'm only 37, so I wasn't alive when it came out. I probably saw it about 25 years ago, maybe for the first time. Ever since then, it's been one of my favorite movies. And the score by Carpenter is fantastic. It looks fantastic. It very easily makes Southern California look like Illinois. Which is a very interesting way to do it, but back then a lot of things were shot in California, not on site. So the moment I saw it, I was in love with this movie. John Carpenter's scores really bring me into his films, and that opening scene, if you have seen this movie, you'll know what I'm talking about. It's incredible. You see everything through Michael's eyes as he walks around and murders his sister, and then the story kind of takes off from there. So, Doug, what's your first memory, if you can remember, of Halloween?
Oh, I got to say, for me, it's definitely the score. You hit it right on the head. I mean, who doesn't know that famous, theme song? Every time you hear it, you know exactly what it is. And I agree with you 100%. And I think that was one of the big draws to that movie was the music, right? I think that it was just eerie. It was done right. It fit perfectly. But the other thing also that stands out, and you also hit it on the head, is the POV, the point of view shots. That was kind of new back then, and you were looking through his mask or his eyes or whatever, whether he was standing in behind a tree or in a closet, like you never saw that before, I think. And so that just gave you a whole different feel, vibe, pace of the show, or sorry, the movie, and it made it that much more eerie, and even though like now you look back and it's kind of like, of course, some of it's low pace and stuff, but back then, like, it was just like he said, it was awesome. It was just, it was great. It just freaked you out. It was eerie, and it was a lot of fun. It still is a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was kind of a slow burn after that opening scene, but I think what it was back then is people weren't used to, and again, I'm speaking just kind of an opinion, I wasn't around back then, but they weren't used to having kind of being punched in the face like right away. Like, you open with that scene, and all of a sudden you're watching this woman get murdered, and then the reveal that it was a small child. Like, I think it takes a while for people to recover from just seeing that for the first time.
Right. I agree. I mean, exactly. I mean, think about it. Think about how intense that really is to do that, and especially back then, when it was released in 78, that they're portraying this child as a murderer, and not only that, but his sister. So it's very dark. Like, it's a very dark beginning, and that grabbed a lot of people's attention.
Yeah, it did, for sure. Wayne, do you have any thoughts? I know you were kind of going back and rewatching this one, I believe, yesterday.
Absolutely. Really, I want to go back and touch on it. And I know Doug already touched on it a little bit. It's just long, slow tracking shots where that's the shape, or Michael Myers, or however. I know he's credited in different ways, which is another question I'm going to have for you guys later on. But just the way it's the shocking sense of foreboding that they institute with these tracking shots just makes your hair stand up on end, but at the same time, it's like you're excited at the same time to see what happens. It's like really, I get a different sense of feel from these horror movies as opposed to other ones that you watch.
Yeah. Well, and with the slasher films, too, and I want to point this out, and I've heard this comment from a couple directors I watch or listen to on podcasts. Slasher movies, too, are meant to be fun. They're not necessarily meant to be something like The Exorcist, which I think when someone, back in the 70s, when people saw a movie like The Exorcist, I think then that sets the bar for horror films, right? So, like, nowadays you see something like The Conjuring or Insidious, and you get, that's the bar. Like, okay, that's what scares me. These movies are meant to be, I think, fun, tense, and to kind of put you on the edge of your seat, but not really, not necessarily want you to be scared, like in a certain, like a jump scare type of way, if you know what I mean, like in a ghost story type of way.
Yeah, I agree. I think you hit it right on the head. It is supposed to be fun, and if you watch, you know, not only Halloween, but even the Friday the 13th and the Freddy, you know, the Nightmare on Elm Street with Freddy Krueger.
Yep.
Same thing. You know, like it's fun. Like if there's some funny parts and there's some silly stuff going on, and you know, of course, like that would never happen, or the cheesy one-liners. And once you immerse yourself into that world, then yeah, you have so much fun with it. And yeah, and on top of that, you get scared. So it's like a full package if you really think about it.
Yeah, for sure. So I mean, this movie when it came out, it was a big hit. It kind of set, even though it was after Chainsaw Massacre, this one set up the slasher boom of the 80s. So because of this movie, we have Friday the 13th, we have Nightmare on Elm Street, Child's Play, The Burning, countless others, Final Exam. I've watched so many 80s slashers that they're not all coming to mind right now. But it set across this thing that people just immediately started making these movies. So it had a huge impact culturally on the horror film business. And I think it also is the reason why it ended up going dry for a while, because so many of them were being made, people just couldn't take it anymore after a while.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. Like, I don't know if it just, do you think the market got oversaturated at any point with these, no?
I think it did. I think what we saw was just too many people. It was the boom. Just like in the early 2000s, it was the remake boom, where every single movie was a remake, they all looked the same, and this was very similar in this day and age. Is like all of a sudden, I think there's like three or four slashers that are considered to be like great slashers. They all came out in 1981, and one of them being, I believe, one of the Friday the 13th, Halloween 2, The Burning, and there was another one. And it's just like that's how you could tell that all of a sudden this thing was starting, and it was good, and business was booming for a while. Everyone was making a lot of money, and then I think it just got tired after a while. But, all right, so that'll lead us into Halloween 2, which is a direct sequel of the first Halloween movie. Again, as we talked about, we all here love the first Halloween movie. It was a classic. Halloween 2 does what most horror movies, I think, should do, and it picks up right where we left off. So it's written by John Carpenter and Deborah Hill again, directed by Rick Rosenthal. It starts with Michael getting shot again, like we see in Halloween 1. And then Donald Pleasance, a.k.a. Dr. Loomis, looks down and sees that he is gone. And then the chase begins, basically. They got to find the killer who's on the loose. Lori is now, comatose almost, because obviously she's like in shock. Her friends have been murdered. She was almost murdered. And we get this kind of sense of hurriness, really. Like this thing he needs to be caught now. And I think this sequel is still pretty good. It's not great. There were some things I noticed while watching it again this week that are kind of ridiculous. I'll go back to the first one real quick, and then I'll ask you guys what you think about these two situations. So in the first movie, the big joke today, 40 years later, is that how did Michael Myers learn how to drive, right? Now in Halloween 2, he performs his own blood transfusion. So no one seems to ask that question. But in Halloween 1, it's how did he learn how to drive? Well, he got behind the car and he learned how to drive. How did he learn to give himself a blood transfusion? That's what I wanted to know. Because there's this scene where this doctor is dead and she's got the blood coming out of her, like out of a tube. So he obviously gave himself blood. It's just so ridiculous. But you can't help but still enjoy the movie, but it's just ridiculous. So what do you guys think about those kind of moments that are kind of taken, like almost take people out of the movie in a sense?
All good points. So it kind of goes back to what we were just saying a minute ago, that these are supposed to be fun, right? They're supposed to be silly. They're supposed to entertain you. And you know, just you talking about the driving and the blood transfusion, like it's just, it's hilarious, you know? But when it comes to Halloween 2, in my opinion, it's one of my favorites because I feel like, as you guys know, you guys are movie buffs, it's usually sequels. It's always the same thing. It's not as good as the first one. You know, it's like, oh, it's never going to touch the original. But I got to tell you guys, like Halloween 2, I think is right there with 1. I love the fact that they picked it up right where they left off when, you know, Michael was gone from the yard. And then, you know, Laurie was on her way to, you know, the hospital, whatever. And I love where it was shot. Like the majority of it was done in a dark hospital, right? Mm-hmm. And it's basically the chase is on there. And so that made it even more scary, I thought, more eerie. And one thing that we haven't touched on yet, but you brought up his name, was Dr. Loomis, right?
Mm-hmm.
He in himself, I thought, was a great character. He was freaky in himself. Like they made him kind of like, you know, like, yes, he was a good guy, but he was kind of odd, you know, and the way he spoke. Odd. He's a great actor. And I thought like he was a gem and perfect for this movie and added so much to the storyline. And not only that, but to the feel of the movie, you know, there was times when he was pretty freaky at times, you know? Mm-hmm. So my take on 2 is that I feel I wouldn't say it's better, but it's like right there with 1. And it's one of the better sequels of any franchise, in my opinion.
To me, it definitely, and we'll get through the rest of them, obviously, but for me, it sits, on this franchise, it sits number 3 or 4, I would say. But that's good, because this week I only watched like the 4 ones, except for the original, because I'm going to watch it at the end of the month. I only watched like the 4 that I really wanted to watch again, and this was one of them. And this one, it still holds up. It's still very entertaining. They up the body count, which is in a sequel usually what you're looking for. And they give us more people, which is always fun. When you see, I always love horror slasher films, when you see like a group of people and you're like, oh, this is going to be good. Because you know that most of them are not going to make it out of the movie.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's just like this, we're going to get, and we got lots of creative kills, I think, in this one, which for back in the 80s is good. Like, those things weren't always happening back then. Some of them were pretty lame in some of the other slasher films. It was a lot of fun.
Yep.
And I really like they keep bringing back Dr. Marion, the Nurse Marion, who comes into play later as well in one of the other sequels. And she is a nice kind of tie-in. The only thing, and this is something that John Carpenter wished he had taken out, is this is the movie that introduces us to the idea of Laurie and Michael being siblings. And I've always kind of just settled with that because that is kind of how I grew up. Like, growing up not being born when these movies came out, Halloween, I had already known before I'd seen the movie that they were brother and sister, right? But that's never mentioned in the first movie. It's kind of like an afterthought. They throw it into the second movie, and it is like almost an afterthought in the second movie because it's a twist that kind of comes at the very end of the movie almost. They're driving in a car, and she's like, oh, I've got something to tell you, but I'm not supposed to tell you. And he's like, well, what is it, woman? And she's like, well, they're brother and sister. And you're like, duh! And it's just the way they reveal it, I thought was like lame. It was very last minute, and I know John Carpenter hated putting it in there, but he put it in there because the studio heads were like, we need something. You got to give us, there's so many of these movies now, you got to separate yourself. And that's what he came up with.
Yeah.
And it kind of settles into the next couple movies as well. It becomes more of a familial thing, and also in Rob Zombie's films as well, too. So what do you guys, what do you think about that, Doug, about the brother-sister connection?
I thought it was a good move. You know, it's kind of like the way you just said it and the way you sold it. It's like, I hate to compare it to one of the best sagas ever, but it's like when Darth Vader's telling Luke, I'm your father. And everyone's like, what? You know, like, what do you, you know, it's kind of one of those twists. So I thought it was genius. I thought it worked great. You know, now there's a purpose of why he's so driven to go after her. You know, it's not just, oh, well, because, you know, he, you know, it's not a random kill. There's meaning behind it now. And then you could build, and they did, build a whole story around it. I thought it was genius.
Yeah, and it was funny you bring up Star Wars there, too, because very similarly, Star Wars 1977, didn't know that Luke and Leia were brother and sister. They put that in Empire. And then in Halloween, right. like I said, it's not mentioned at all that they're even related. And then you kind of throw it in the sequel. Right. So that was the 80s were the thing for just throwing in weird twists in the middle of movies that, that were not mentioned at all. And like we have Luke and Leia, what, kissing in the first Star Wars or about to. I can't remember. I'm not, you know, you guys know Star Wars more than I do. All right, go ahead, Wayne.
Just jumped again on a couple of things. I think he learned how to drive, just basically being transported around and watching the guys who are transporting him.
See, right, and you can make that assumption.
I believe that he was able to... Hey, they're going to throw out random craziness. I'm going to throw out random crazy things to justify it. And then with the blood transfusion, you know, I'm sure he's been sedated a lot in his life, so maybe he just kind of figured out, you know, if the needle goes here and this goes here, you know, he seems like, you know, he's like a sociopath, you know, so he's very laser focused on certain aspects of things, you know, and throw it out there. All right. And then as far as the brother, sister, siblings aspect of it, I guess it's kind of justifying Michael Myers' just obsession with Laurie throughout. Mm-hmm. It gives it reason and purpose or merit even. Yeah, I mean, I get it. I dig it. I don't have a problem with it.
Okay. All right. Well, and that's, you know, like I said, it's one of those things that is always, to me, kind of just sat there because the creator wasn't happy with how what he did. I've always kind of wondered what everybody else thought. So we'll move on to what I think most people, until recently, have considered the worst Halloween movie of all time. We're not going to spend a lot of time on it. I'm the only one that's watched it recently.
But Mike, if you can, because you're going to be the expert on this one, maybe you could touch base on why it went to left field. Like, what made them go this route?
Okay, so right? There are a couple things here. Carpenter wasn't going to come back. Because he was like I said, he wasn't super happy. He still produced the movie. He didn't want to come back and do another Michael Myers movie. They wanted to basically take Halloween and turn it into an anthology series. So, like, each movie would be separate, right? So what they did was they had Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, just one year later. And it was just kind of, let's take the title, but it's going to be something else. It's going to be different. Now, obviously, fans were expecting Michael Myers. And that's not how this worked out. It's a movie about a company who sells Halloween masks, and those Halloween masks, once the kids have them on, it like possesses them and it kills them. And that's the premise. And so Tom Atkins, he's the like sheriff, or no, he's a doctor. He's a doctor and he figures it out. And he tries to go to the factory where they're making these masks and shut it down. And he has this girl that he takes with him along the way. She's a friend or a daughter of like one of his colleagues, I think. And so they go and they try to stop this. And the movie came out on a $2.5 million budget. It only made $14 million. Now, granted, you look at that, it made its budget back. But that's not what they expected out of a Halloween movie. Now, as a Halloween movie, this movie doesn't make any sense. Because in the movie itself, they're actually watching the original Halloween on TV. So right there, you take the original franchise and you go, well, this is a movie within this world. So Halloween 3 Season of the Witch takes place like in our world where Halloween is a movie. And you can't really do anything after that with Michael Myers because you've already made him now a character in a film. So there's no way they could take this movie and go back and reinsert Michael Myers. Unless you want to do totally meta, kind of like a New Nightmare from Wes Craven. They could have, but they weren't thinking like that back in the 80s. So it bombs, it tanks, everyone hates it. No one knows why it happened. Everyone's confused. It takes them a few years to really get back to the idea that they need to bring Michael Myers back. But since this movie came out in 1982 to now, it has actually become a cult classic. There are actually people that think it's one of the better movies of the franchise, even though, like, I would argue that it's a good movie on its own, but I'm not going to, if you are rating it within the franchise, it's going to be at the bottom because it's not part of the franchise, really. You understand? You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
So it just, I don't know why they, like, outside of the fact that Carpenter didn't want to do another Michael Myers movie, I don't know why they thought it was like, let's go ahead with this. The studio still had a chance to stop,
right?
And they did. You know what I mean? So
yeah, and that's my question. I'd love to talk to some of those executives, you know, who were involved with those decisions back then. And I would want to ask why. I mean, actually, you explained it beautifully, which we get. But what I'm saying is, did they really sit there and when they watched and screened it, did they say, "Yeah, this is a winner," or "Yep, we got it," or did they all go, "This is going to go nowhere"? You know what I mean? Because
yeah.
I mean, I've seen the movie. I've seen it a few times.
Yeah.
And you, I was like everybody else, like, I don't get it. Like, what is this? You know,
yep.
it was, I don't know, a total miss in my opinion. Total miss.
So here's
a question.
Sure. Go ahead.
So there is no connection to Michael Myers at all. Correct.
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 You'd think that because of the mask aspect, he would have incorporated that in some way, somehow, like the mask absorbs the powers and poisons all the other masks. It just seems like you could have had something, unless they deliberately just wanted no connection whatsoever. We're just taking a right turn.
Yes.
We're taking it a different direction.
They deliberately, I'm going to read you right here. They deliberately wanted no connection. John Carpenter and Deborah Hill believed that the Halloween series had the potential to be an anthology series of films that centered around the night of Halloween, with each sequel containing its own character, setting, and storyline. Director Wallace stated that there were many ideas for Halloween-themed films, some of which could have potentially created any number of their own sequels, and The Season of the Witch was meant to be the first. So right out the gate, you have this movie that's ready to be the first of a franchise, and it fails. So what do? You cancel everything that you had after that, and you go and you make a Michael Myers themed film called Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers, which they had to do because they got rid of Michael Myers. So The Return of Michael Myers was filmed in the late 80s. So it came out in 1988. It's directed by Dwight H. Little, written by Ally B. McElroy, and starring Donald Pleasance, Ellie Cornell, and introduces Danielle Harris as Jamie Lloyd, a.k.a. the daughter of Laurie Strode. And Danielle Harris was very young when this movie came out. This was her, I believe, her debut role. And Donald Pleasance returns. We should start with this. At the end of Halloween 2, Michael Myers and Donald Pleasance presumably die in a giant fire that engulfs them in flames. In Halloween 4, Michael Myers is still, as they think, in a coma after all this time. And he's really just, I guess, pretending to be docile because he kills the people that are trying to transfer him to a new place, and he breaks free. So Donald Pleasance, Dr. Loomis, is then brought back into the fold, and he's worried that he got out. There's like, again, it's like there's like a car accident or something. The van, they use this in the more recent Halloween movie. There's some sort of accident where he's presumed dead, but then they find out that he's actually alive. And what I think's funny is, again, they were engulfed in flames. If you saw Halloween 2, they should have been burnt to a crisp. Dr. Loomis has a tiny scar on the side of his face. so that you go, oh, well, he must have got that really tiny scar from burning in flames.
Right.
That being said, this is still a very enjoyable movie. It has a lot of good kills in it. Jamie Lloyd is an awesome new character. It feeds off of the family thing, so now her uncle's trying to kill her. It messes with the psychological part of it a little bit, too, which I thought was very interesting. We get that a little bit in Rob Zombie's second entry, but this one really kind of is the first one, I think, to delve into that the relationship between the two is more of a psyche thing than it is like a familial connection. And it was a very interesting addition. The worst thing about this movie, I think, is the mask. And if you haven't seen it recently, definitely look up pictures. While the first mask was bought at a hardware store, this mask looks like an actual mask you would probably buy in, like, the dollar bin at a hardware store. It's terrible. It is really
that's
bad.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
It's so bad. And it's bad in the fifth one, too. But it's just not good. But, like I said, the movie itself I thought was very fun. Doug, did you get a chance to rewatch this one?
I did, actually. And I got to tell you, I really enjoyed it. It had been a long time since I've seen this one, and 5. And, you know, the first thing I got to say is that Jamie Lloyd, the little girl, was phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
I thought she was a great actor. I thought she delivered on all, you know, considering – how little she was, and you got to remember what, you know, back in 88, and just her intense scenes, like, it was draining me as I was watching her. I'm like, man, this little girl's like just pumping it out in every scene. And, you know, I like that, okay, you know, it's Uncle Michael Myers coming now, you know, Ken had to tie it into the family and things like that. I was, it was great to see Dr. Loomis back, and, you know, just kind of rebranding everything, bringing back everything, like, you know, to most of us now after Halloween 3, we're like, okay, this is what we're looking for. And it was shot the same way, you know, the lighting was the same way, the same POV shots, the slow panning and tracking that Wayne talked about earlier, like, all that was back, you know. So I think all of us Halloween diehard fans appreciated that, you know, and even more so when I watched it this last week. And I don't know, I forgot just how good it was, or maybe I just didn't appreciate it back then. But now I'm like, man, Halloween 4 was, it was right up there. And, you know, well, the ending, how can we not talk about the ending?
The
right?
ending,
yeah. It was a great, the ending to me, I think, stamps it, like, it was probably, and still is, one of the freakiest scenes I've ever seen in a horror movie. Like, it's just, you sit there and go, what? And I really wish they would have played off that moving forward in 5, 6 or whatever. And we'll get into that in a minute. But I just thought that the way they took it to that little girl and what happened with her, you know, when she touched Michael Myers' hand, something happened, obviously, and his evilness transferred to her or whatever it was. They were onto something there. And I'm like, wow, that was really freaky.
They were. You know? And it's
so I enjoyed it.
It's great. And it's a great callback to the first movie. Because the first movie is Michael with in the Halloween, in the clown costume standing in the driveway with the knife. This is Jamie as well in some sort of clown costume standing in the hallway with a knife after just stabbing her foster mother or whatever she's, I think it's foster mother.
Mom. Yeah, foster mom. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's a very, it is, you kind of get that parallel between the opening scene of Halloween and the ending scene of Halloween 4. And that was great too, because they could have been like a great ending. To, like, you know, I'm glad that they've continued, because I like some of the later movies, but it could have been a great ending, I think, to those first three movies. Not, obviously not counting Season of the Witch. So Halloween, Halloween 2, and Halloween 4.
Right. Right.
But, you know, obviously it made money. It was back. So Michael Myers is back. People wanted to see him. And it was unfortunately, Wayne, do you have any questions about Halloween 4 at all?
I'm really just enjoying your guys' conversation back and forth.
So, okay, so.
Good.
Great, yeah.
Good.
So they had this good ending, as we just talked about, and then they're like, let's do Halloween 5. Well, Halloween 5, I didn't get a chance to rewatch this one, because like I said, I was trying to rewatch the ones I really wanted to watch again. And unfortunately, Halloween 5 isn't one that I feel is one I need to watch all the time. Halloween 5, The Revenge of Michael Myers, came out in 1989, directed by Dominique O'Thenan-Gerard. Donald Pleasence and Daniel Harris return as Jamie and Dr. Loomis. Jamie is now like in a foster, or like a an orphanage or something, right, Doug? That's how it starts?
Right.
And
you're right.
So, you know, Michael's back again. Now everyone's watching Jamie because they think she might be crazy. So I think part of it, too, is they're trying to, like, kind of offset what she did at the end of the first movie. Like, well, she was traumatized, and sometimes when traumatized people have stuff happen to them, this stuff happens. Really didn't care for this one that much. It's got some good kills, if I remember correctly. The man in black at the end is very strange, because they never, ever go back to it ever again in the series. it kind of comes across a little bit in the next one, but what are your thoughts on this one, Doug, since you just watched it recently?
Yeah, so I feel like they really missed the mark on this one. I agree with you. It could have been way better. Yes, it had some good kills, like you said, and it was fun at some parts, but again, because they had found this little girl, the character Jamie, and the way they ended it in Halloween 4, there was so much they could have done with in 5. And they actually, she could have been the next Michael Myers. She could have, you know, taken the reins, if you will, and moved on, and they could have done something fun with it. But instead, like you said, they put her in psychiatric ward or a hospital, you know, obviously because what had happened. But it was odd because for the longest time, if you remember halfway through the movie, like the first half of the movie, she doesn't speak.
Yeah.
She's almost like mute, right? She doesn't say a word. So I feel like that's that they missed the mark there, because she's a great actor, and instead the muter. Like, you know, she can't say a word.
Yep.
And then little by little she starts speaking again, and I get it because she was traumatized, and I get all that. But and they brought the family back at like her I guess her, you would call her sister.
Yeah, her foster her
foster sister. Right?
Yeah, it was the sister who was the daughter of those two people, I believe.
Yes. Exactly. So she was still kind of looking out for her. She was still there for her, and she was like, "I'm here. Don't worry." And then, of course, everything starts all over again, and Michael's coming back, and that kind of stuff. I was so happy with the way they did four that I felt five could have been that much better. And I think they missed the target. And it's good. It's fun. I would tell your listeners to definitely check it out and watch it. But it's not as strong as four. Yeah, no way. And it could have been great.
Yeah, it could have
done so much more with the ending of four, and they just didn't.
Right, exactly. They could have really kind of knocked it out of the park, and they failed. And that happens sometimes. However, it at least is better than the next one. And that is Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers, came out in 1995, directed by Joe Chappelle, no relation to Dave. Stars, again, for the final time in his final film performance, Donald Pleasance as Dr. Loomis, and brings in Paul Rudd as Tommy Doyle, who Tommy Doyle is the little kid in the first movie that Laurie is babysitting. And it involves an older Jamie, pregnant, and then these people kidnap her, and they steal her baby, and they kill her. Or they try to steal her baby, and they kill her. Paul Rudd finds the baby, because I think she calls him. And so he's like, oh my god. And like, so he's protecting the baby, and there's someone else. Then there's a new female that comes into it, because Jamie's dead now. And people are trying to take the baby and raise Michael Myers. It's like a cult, and there's a curse involved, and some supernatural shit. It is so off the walls. I have no idea really like what they were trying to do. It's so out there. And I've watched both the original cut and the producer's cut, which some people swear by. I'll tell you, I watched the producer's cut. I think it was last year. It's also terrible, just in a different way. So like, I just don't get this movie. The only fond memory I have of this movie was watching it on pay-per-view in 95 and kind of being introduced to Paul Rudd. And that's about it. Other than that, it's pretty terrible.
Yeah, I agree with you. I went back and rewatched it as well. And I'm like, oh, Paul Rudd. Like, totally forgot about that, right?
Yep.
But I'm not sure what they were trying to do here. I didn't, the whole baby thing and the cult and it just, I didn't get it. You know, I'm sitting there going, okay, I don't think it was as extreme as, you know, Halloween 3, but the curse of Michael Myers, like, what are they trying to, what's the curse? What, you know, what's the, with the baby and the cult? I don't know. They missed the mark on this one. I'm not a fan of this one. I was, you know, kind of disappointed when I rewatched it. I'm like, oh yeah, I remember now. And, you know, you're absolutely right. It's just not one of their best moments. And, you know, and that's why I'm kind of, you know, I'm bummed because, like I said, going back to four, from four on, they really could have done some really neat things. And it just kind of, it didn't go that way. But, so I'd have to say Halloween, you know, The Curse of Michael Myers is not one of their stronger ones.
So there comes the end of the first timeline. Sorry, Wayne, did you have something to say?
Next question.
Go ahead.
So we've seen like the series or the franchise kind of resurrect and get back on track with four and then kind of go off the rails again with five. I wanted to bring up the aspect of the kill counts and just, you know, the actual, you know, slasher kill, you know, the reason for these movies to exist.
Mm-hmm.
If we compare these to other franchises, like Friday the 13th and even like Friday the 13th, it seems like Halloween kind of, you know, stays and maintains, like, you know, the kill, the hunt, the slash, the murder, and everything. Do you think that's why, in your opinion, the Halloween franchise kind of excels above the other ones, even if you feel that way?
That's how I feel, I think, about them, is that it definitely, I think it takes it a little bit more seriously, I guess, if I had to say, where, like, in, like, Halloween, I think, gives you characters that you like. You like Laurie, you like Dr. Loomis, you like Jamie Lloyd. where I can't honestly tell you any of the people in Friday the 13th franchise. I like those movies, but I don't know their names. And they're just people to get murdered, basically. Corey Feldman's Tommy Jarvis. There's one. I got you one. But that's because, you know, I'm a huge Corey Feldman fan. But for me, yeah, I think it's just the consistency of Michael just being kind of this unstoppable force. But still, like I said, he's still attacking these characters that you do actually care for. So I think it kind of gives you that good... You, in a good horror film, you got to have a bad guy you like, I think, and a good guy you like, so that you can kind of have some skin in the game when it comes to the end. Like, oh man, I really like how they did Michael Myers, but I also love Laurie Strode. And she's, in my opinion, one of the best final girls ever, probably the best. So I think it's just because they gave us that type of a character, that's what sets it above for me.
Yeah, I agree 100%. You're absolutely right. When you said, I can't give you one name from Friday the 13th, yeah, I couldn't do the same, exact same thing. So I think you're right. I agree with you 100% on that.
All right.
I'm just curious where you guys thought, like, where Halloween excels over the other ones. And what comes to mind to me was that kill count, that consistency, and, mm-hmm. you know, the character. Obviously, you guys got into the characters, too. Yeah, you're all really, really correct. Great insight. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, and another thing, just going back to what we talked about, I think also because it's a family thing, right? It's mm-hmm. a brother, it's a sister, it's this whole, you know, the thought of that in itself is very dark. So we're, you know, Jason from Friday the 13th, you know, the guy, you know, at a camp where he kills all these camp counselors, okay? You know, there's no real connection. Freddy Krueger, Nightmare on Elm Street, same thing. There was really, outside of, well, I don't know, with Freddy, what was it, Mike? Was it did he get made fun of, or
no, he was killing children, so that there is a connection.
Oh, right.
There he was killing children, so there the parents,
a connection there. yeah
the parents, yes. Band together to murder
so they
him.
Took it upon themselves, and they,
yes,
yeah,
and he
right yeah okay, so that maybe, yeah,
that one, then that,
yeah,
one's
so that's
better.
Maybe more along the lines of,
yeah, Halloween. And that has also a final girl we like, too, and Nancy. Nancy is, now she's another one. She wasn't in all of them, but she comes mm-hmm. back every now and then. And she was always a really good character, I think.
Right.
All right.
Exactly.
Next we're going to get to, I think, one of my favorite in the franchise, and maybe it's just because I liked horror films that came out in the late 90s, Halloween H2O 20 years later. So this is where we get into the Halloween timelines. So we just finished Timeline 1. Timeline 1 is Halloween, Halloween 2, Halloween 4, Halloween 5, and Halloween 6. This is Timeline 2. Timeline 2 is Halloween, Halloween 2, and Halloween H2O 20 years later. So it skips 4 and 5, obviously 3 and 6. So it skips 4, 5, and 6. And we get Jamie Lee Curtis coming back as Laurie Strode. And she has a son instead of a daughter, and it's Josh Hartnett, and he's about 17 years old. Michelle Williams is also in this before she started doing Oscar-caliber work. And this movie, I thought, got back to basics. They start off, it's really great, too, because in the 90s they would start off kind of how they did in the first movie, that opening kill. Well, the opening kill in this one is Nurse Marion from the first two movies. So they bring, it's the same actress, they bring her back. They throw a famous person, Joseph Gordon-Levitt. He's in the very beginning of this movie. He does not make it. So if you're a fan, maybe watch just the first 5 minutes, and then you can stop. But this movie is, like I said, to me, a back to basics. Michael kind of comes, and he stalks them. He kills them. And then we get Halloween, H2O. And then it goes to this. It does take us from Illinois, though, out to California. I think a lot of people were not happy with that. That didn't bother me as much, as it kind of makes sense that once Laurie survived what she survived, that she would want to get as far away as possible. And she does. She tries to, you know, not think about it, but she has this thought that her brother's going to come back and he's going to murder her. And that makes her a tough mom because she doesn't want her son ever to leave her sight. She's divorced. She works with kids all day, so her life is kind of a wreck from time to time. And eventually what happens is we'll all kind of know what's going to happen in this type of movie. Michael Myers comes back and he starts taking out people. This one does not have a giant kill count in it. I kind of like that because it does kind of get back to the slow burn of the first one. But it's also only an hour and a half long, so it's not like you got to wait forever. And it has some good kills in it, and I think Jamie Lee is probably at her best. The one downside I would say is they do throw in a lot of like cheesy jump scares, which is something that Scream did. So I think they took took it from Scream, but maybe not realize that Scream was doing it to be funny, and was doing it because Scream was making fun of jump scares, and Halloween kind of took that idea and used it in this movie. But I enjoyed it. And the moment when Jamie Lee Curtis, aka Laurie Strode, like kicks into full gear the last like 20 minutes is freaking awesome. So, what are your thoughts on this one, Doug?
You know what? I went back and watched this one as well. And I enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. It was, I liked the idea that she was hiding.
Mm-hmm.
She changed her identity, her name. You know, she was this, teacher or, you know, or principal or whatever it was. And then they were going on this big camping trip, and I agree. I was okay with them getting away from, you know, Illinois and her, you know, hiding out somewhere else and, you know, still having these, you know, flashbacks. I like that they added a son to the mix now, her son.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I thought it was fun. You know, all these other actors. I mean, LL Cool J was in this one.
Yep.
You know, that was like, oh, yeah, LL was in it. Adam Arkin, you know, the guy from, you know, Hitch. There was a lot of, you know, good actors in this movie. I thought that where they took the story with the, like you said, the new timeline or the second timeline,
mm-hmm.
I was fine with, you know,
yeah.
And it was great to see her back. I don't feel like it was forced, you know, I don't feel like it was like, oh, let's just, you know, put Jamie in it and, you know, just we're going to make a lot of money because Jamie's back.
Yeah.
I thought it was done very well.
Yeah, I thought it was good. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it when it came out. That's probably what really started for me. My love for the Halloween franchise, because I think I'd seen the first one by then, but I hadn't like quite fallen in love with it. And then when I saw this movie, I probably went back and watched the old ones even more. Because yeah, this came out in 98, so I was
right.
Still kind of maturing in my film watching ways. Wayne, did you ever see this one?
I saw this one in the theaters with a group of friends, and I was hiding the fact that I was terrified of horror movies and all these things. And I probably spent half of the movie, or a good portion of with my eyes halfway shut just because I'm a big coward. But one of the reasons I saw this movie and was willing to was because Michelle Williams was in it because of her the Dawson's Creek fame and the whole thing going on. So that was my in because I had a huge crush on the gun character. A little bit not really hinging too much on the movie and what happened, but that's the reason why I was but
nice.
I don't want to wait for this movie to be over.
Nice. I like that. I like the call, the tie in there.
That's awesome. I think that the movie did a nice job of resetting, explaining the storyline. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it did. It really made it
what Halloween's about, who Michael Myers was.
Yeah, it made it so you didn't have to see the first one in order to see this one. Which is nice when they do that, because you know there's a lot of people that just go to the movies and they're like, oh, this seems good, and may not know what the franchise is about. So it does give a nice little opening. Obviously, it helps if you've seen the rest of them. But no, like I said, I think it was a good return, which is why, and it's just like 4. We get 4, 5 sucks. We get 7, and then technically 8 comes after, and... Jesus Christ, I have no idea what the hell is going on in this movie. Halloween Resurrection, 2002. Rick Rosenthal returns after he directed Halloween 2, a good Halloween movie. And we get Busta Rhymes, Bianca Kulagic, Thomas Ian Nichols, Ryan Merriman, Sean Patrick Thomas, Tyra Banks, and Jamie Lee Curtis for like 5 seconds. And it was... Okay, so we'll start at the beginning. Laurie Strode is in a mental institution. Apparently, she didn't chop off Michael Myers' head at the end of H2O. It was some guy, EMT or whatever. And then she's in the mental institution because she killed somebody. Her son's nowhere to be found. We don't know where he is. He never comes back again. Michael shows up, and obviously Jamie Lee was like, you give me a lot of money and I'll be in this movie, but I only want to be in it for like 5 minutes. They kill her. So that's it. Starts
exactly.
off with Laurie.
Exactly.
It starts off with Laurie Strode dying, and you're like, "What the hell?" And it just from there, it basically just goes downhill. I mean, Doug, you said you watched it again. What are your direct thoughts after viewing it?
Okay, so a few things. So to going back to the end of, I agree with you 100%. Halloween, you know, 2 was great, and then whatever. So Halloween Resurrection, or Halloween H2O, if you guys go back and watch the movie, pay attention to the end. It's actually, it was a pretty good ending. I'm like, yes. Oh, wow. Like it ended, you know, with Jamie taking Michael Myers, and she knew that he was going to come back. So she's like, I don't trust, you know, anybody else. I'm going to take care of this myself. And she drives off with Michael Myers in a body bag. She goes over a cliff. She takes an axe and, you know, takes his head off. And we're like, whoa, this is it. This is how do you come back from this, right?
Yep.
Okay. So then, you know, I was like, yeah, how did they bring it all back? So then you're watching Halloween Resurrection and then explain how Michael Myers is actually still alive, which was actually, I thought that was a good part of it. Like, I'm like, oh, wow, that was actually creative. Okay. I can go with it, fine. But after that, it just, it didn't really go anywhere. This time, I feel like Jamie, she was forced in there. You know, she was just like, okay, let's just put her in there and pay her some money. And I feel like the way that they killed her off was so weak, considering the magnitude of this franchise and who she was to the story and to Halloween, that, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis, just, they could have done a better job. I don't know how. I'm not saying I could have done a better job of telling the story, but the way they killed her off was so weak and so disappointing that I think after I saw that, I'm like, oh, I'm not, like, I don't think I even gave the movie a fair shake after that, because I was so disappointed. Yeah. But it's just an okay movie. It's kind of, for the people who haven't seen it yet, it's kind of like pre-reality TV.
Yes.
Is really what it is, right? It's before all reality shows that everybody knows of nowadays, but it was really a reality show. And what did they call it? What did Busta Rhymes call it? Instead of entertainment, dangertainment.
Dangertainment.
Yeah. He's like, we're going to do dangertainment. And, you know, while they had, you know, Tyra Banks is in here, there's a few other, you know, heavy hitters that went on to do other things. But you know, the whole Busta Rhymes thing and him with karate and him, it just didn't work. One thing I did notice was on this one, they seemed to be able to beat Michael Myers up a little bit more. Like,
yes.
He kept, you know, like they would swing at him and he would like go down. Obviously, he'd come back up. But it just seemed like all the other Halloween movies, like you wouldn't even touch him. You couldn't even move him if you punched him in the face. Here, he would fall over. He'd, you know, trip. He, like, I'm like, okay. So, yeah, I'm not a fan. You know, they again missed the mark after H2O, but, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, it's just, it was a disappointment. I do have to, Katie Sackhoff from, TV show was she on? Battlestar Galactica, she had an early role in that, and she has a cool death scene. Luke Kirby is an actor I know. He plays the stoner. He was pretty fun. But overall, it's just not a very good movie. Busta Rhymes has the most memorable line, but people hate it. They're trick or treat, motherfucker. And it's just like...
that's right.
When he says it, you just go...
Right.
So, moving on, because that ends Timeline 2. So we'll get to Timeline 3 in a second here. We're going to talk very briefly about the Rob Zombie remakes. 2007 came along. Rob Zombie decided the Weinsteins wanted a remake, so they went to Rob Zombie, and he said he would never do a remake, but then he kind of thought about it, and it was a chance for him to tell his own version of Halloween. And we get 2007's Halloween, so that is the second movie titled Halloween that we have. And it's not bad. Rob Zombie, I like Rob Zombie's films. Some people are not fans of him. He wrote, directed, produced it. It has a good young cast, I think. Well, not young necessarily, but Malcolm McDowell, obviously, he comes in as Dr. Loomis. Sherry Moon Zombie plays Michael's mom. Tyler Mane plays Michael Myers. Scout Taylor Compton is the new Laurie. Brad Dourif is the new Sheriff, and Sheriff Brackett. And Danielle Harris actually returns to the series. She plays Annie Brackett this time as a teenager. And William Forsythe plays the horrible, abusive stepdad, alcoholic douchebag to Michael Myers. So we get this backstory, which is what the big thing was about this movie, was it had a little backstory. It's about 15, 20 minutes of why he became who he was. He was bullied. He was picked on. His family sucked. They were all white trash. They were abusive. Very different than the original franchise. Very much a Rob Zombie movie. And it really, like,
I
that part
like this aspect of it.
Sorry, go ahead, Wayne.
Sorry, man, not to cut you off. I apologize.
No, go repeat what you said.
I really like this aspect of seeing his past and really delving into, like, what contributed to his descent into madness, if you will, or just what really brought out the sociopathic serial killer or aspect of it. Because, like, watching the other movies, it's always been like, why? And this kind of sheds light on it. For me, it worked.
And it works in the context of this film. I'm just glad they never did it in the original series, because the whole idea behind it was he was this unstoppable force, and you weren't supposed to really know who he was or why he was doing it. And I like that kind of aspect of it. I didn't need, I guess, this... And that's why I said I was a little disappointed with the brother-sister story. I didn't need that connection to keep enjoying these movies. And it's just like this, like... While he did a good job with it in this film, and it works with this movie, I'm just still glad that they didn't do it with the original franchise, and that this one kind of sits on its own. Dag French, who plays the young Michael Myers, I think he did a good job. He looked really crazy. That's pretty much all that was required. This one's a little longer, too, than most of the other movies. It's about 110 minutes, because after that opening scene, which is, I guess, probably about 30 minutes, you get the whole original Halloween movie. And I thought they did a good job at redoing that. Lots of good kills again. Very Rob Zombie-esque. Very mid-2000s. That's the way it kind of looked, like a very mid-2000s horror film. The cast was really good. Lots of great supporting characters. He manages to get all these other horror people like to do cameos and stuff in his movie. Danielle Harris, again, was awesome. This time as Annie Brackett. Scout Taylor Compton was really good as Laurie. It's one of those movies I've revisited a few times, and it just doesn't hold up like it did when I first saw it. And maybe when I first saw it, it was because I was just hankering for more Halloween. So I was just glad I got what I got. And now it's just... I like it still. I'm just not in love with it like I was when it first came out.
Yeah, you know what? I was pumped when I heard Rob Zombie had signed up for it. I'm like, oh, this is going to be epic. It's going to be dark. It's going to be eerie, and it's going to be intense. And, you know, while obviously, you know, fast forward from 1978 to 2007, the way it's shot, the way it's edited, obviously way more slick and this and that. And I love the idea that they were going to go back to the backstory of Michael. I was like, that's what intrigued me, right? Like Wayne said, I'm like, oh, I do want to know about all that. But I got to be honest with you, I was disappointed. I felt like there was at times I thought it was a little too slow. I don't know if it was the dialogue or what, but I was just like, maybe I was just expecting this, because I know Rob from the music world, right? Like, I've seen Rob Zombie live and his stage shows, and I know he has haunted houses, and he's like big into all this stuff. So I was expecting, maybe I was expecting too much, and I don't know. But I agree. I watched it, and you know, I walked away going, it was just all right. Like, it wasn't, you know, there was one or two cool scenes. I mean, the mask was cool, and that, and the backstory, but it didn't stick with me. I don't know. I don't really know why, but. It just wasn't it wasn't as good as I was expecting it to be.
I don't think the acting was there. It wasn't believable. I didn't really care about the characters being killed.
Yeah, that's, I would say that happens, I think. In this one, Annie lives, actually. She doesn't die until the sequel. So we did get that, too. He did make a couple changes, and I believe that he kills more people, especially since we start with him, like, killing somebody when he was a kid. But not his sister. Well, his sister plus that other person, because he kills the kid from Spy Kids in the forest. Or maims him, at least. I can't remember if he I think he does murder him, though. So, and it starts with him, like, killing animals and stuff. So that kind of stuff is always hard to take as well. So then he made a sequel in 2009. I really dislike this movie. Maybe I should watch it again. Some people told me to give it another chance. I can't even, like, okay, so I rented it. This is when I still worked in Blockbuster, or one of us did, me and my wife. And I rented it, and she doesn't like these movies, but she watched it because it was just sitting at home. I was at work. I got home, and she's like, yeah, I watched it. It was really bad. I'm like, no, it wasn't. You just don't like these movies. I'm going to watch it, and I'll tell you that you were wrong. I watched it, and I was like, wow, she's right. This movie is terrible. It really goes off the rails with this psychological nonsense. It kind of tries to do what they did in 4, but more in your face with the, where Laurie, like, starts to go crazy and starts to think, is she crazy? What's going on? And it's like there's a unicorn in his dreams where his mom's on the unicorn. I don't know what he was thinking. It's definitely more of a Rob Zombie movie than a Halloween movie. It's bizarre. I don't get it. I didn't care for it. And I've only seen it once. So if that says anything.
That says a lot.
Yeah.
Because it's rare that you only see one movie. You see a movie once. So that says a lot. I'll be honest with you, because I was so disappointed with Halloween, I didn't give Halloween 2 a chance, 2009 version. Maybe I should, just to say I saw it, but
I would watch it.
I just remember going,
but it's worth watching it once.
But don't.
Yeah. All right. So
okay.
We'll move on to, we'll try to move a little quickly here, but we'll move on to the final Halloween film that's been released recently. And this is the third timeline. So this timeline just covers two movies so far. There are two more coming, but it goes Halloween and then Halloween 2018. It's almost like it's a continuation of the first movie, which is why it's just called Halloween. It's directed by David Gordon Green, written by him, Jeff Fradley, and Danny McBride, who most people know for his comedy. It's the 11th installment of the Halloween franchise, direct sequel to 1978. I love this movie. To me, this is like the true sequel, because it, and again, I know we talked about the brother-sister thing, but it gets rid of that, and it just, again, it turns him into this thing that they just, people can't stop. And I love that aspect of this series. I love the aspect of this movie. When he finds his mask again, when he starts to kill again, like everything kind of comes full circle. And I've heard people talk about too, like, well, how does he find Laurie? He doesn't find Laurie. He's brought to Laurie. And I think that's the idea to get here, is he's not necessarily looking for Laurie. They never specifically say that in this franchise. He just starts killing again when he gets out. And that's what I love about it. He goes to this suburb and he just starts murdering people. And it's awesome. And I love this movie. I love the homages to the original. They have one of the victims is in the ghost sheet. Another one is stabbed to the wall, just like in the first movie. There's just so many stuff here that I love about this movie. They also have the woman in the second movie with the popcorn who lives in the second movie, but in this one she does not, with the rollers in her hair. Michael Myers does not kill a baby, so he does have a limit, but he does kill a small child. So that shows you that he would basically just mostly kill anybody that gets in his way. I really dug this movie. So I don't know, Doug, what your thoughts on it. I know, Wayne, you saw it with me. So
I this one I have not seen, to be honest with you guys. Actually was waiting to hear what you guys were going to say about it, because I was so disappointed with the zombie franchise, but if what you're telling me is true, then I'm all over it, because it sounds like they came back and they're doing it right again.
Yeah, I won't spoil it then for you, but yeah, it's really good. Wayne, what are your thoughts on this one? I know you saw it with me.
Absolutely, yes. This is one of the ones where I ended up and tagged along with you to go see this one in the theater. And I think, to my credit, I only jumped like four or five times, which is amazing for me. not to spoil the ending, but it's great. But so the scene where he's in the one of the victims is in a fenced-in area, and he's kind of being
so good
hunted, if you will, with motion cat fight, is just so fantastic. With just the sense of impending doom, like I'm closing my eyes right now, and I'm picturing being this person where it's dark. Oh, Oh my god! Excuse my yelling, but that's how I felt. Just reminiscing about this.
It's awesome. Really good. It's some definitely, Doug, you should watch it, check it out.
Well, I got one question on that. So just to go back, so for this version 2018, is it relaunched from the beginning?
No, it's a sequel to the first movie.
Okay,
so this franchise, this part of the story will be Halloween, the 2018 Halloween, and then Halloween Kills and Halloween Ends. Those are the next two sequels. Right. One will be out next year.
Right. No, but what I'm asking though is Halloween 2018, complete reboot?
No. It's a sequel to the first movie. Yeah, it's a sequel to the 78 version.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. Direct sequel, yeah. So it's, it starts with Laurie kind of being crazy and like living in a shack.
Gotcha.
Yeah, okay. It's good. It's definitely good. So that wraps up our Halloween conversation. All right, so we move on to our next part, which is the review of the week. We will review this the brand new movie, The Trial of the Chicago 7, written and directed by Aaron Sorkin, starring Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, Sacha Baron Cohen, Daniel Flaherty, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Michael Keaton, Frank Langella, John Carroll Lynch, Eddie Redmayne, Noah Robbins, Mark Rylance, Alex Sharp, and Jeremy Strong. It is about the riots in Chicago in the late 60s at the Democratic National Convention. 8 people were arrested. 7 of them were put on trial together. One of them was Bobby Seale, who was the lead of the Black Panther movement, and he was put on a separate trial. Well, he was bunched in with them, but he was not really part of them. And they talk about that in this movie, just to kind of explain why it's called the Trial of the Chicago 7. And it goes into, it's basically a court drama, which if you're familiar with Aaron Sorkin, you're obviously familiar with A Few Good Men, which is also a court drama. So he does that kind of stuff very well. We get the kind of set the tone with everybody getting ready to go to the convention and like pre all the riots and stuff. And then we jump ahead after the convention to the court case. And then we kind of get the bits of the riots and how everything happened in the past in flashbacks and stuff. Let me start and just say, I don't know how you guys feel about this movie. I loved it. I thought it was great. I was into it the entire time. It's obviously a very timely movie. It deals with protest and riots and stuff that's been happening for quite some time now in the last 6 or 7 months. And I think it kind of is a hot button topic, and it's kind of right time for this movie to come out. Obviously, it has its own agenda, I'll say, but that's, you know, if you're kind of into that, if you understand what happened back then and what's happening right now, you kind of can see the parallels, and it shows how sometimes in the history of this country that we, you know, people are used for political points of view and gains and stuff like that. And I think this movie really drives that home. And I think the performances are spectacular, specifically from Sacha Baron Cohen and Jeremy Strong. But everybody, I think, is really good in this movie. Wayne, I'll throw it to you.
Yeah, just to start off light and fun, to see Sacha Baron Cohen not as like a Borat or a Bruno type character or Ali G, his performance was really surprising and really, really refreshing for me, because I don't really care for those characters that he usually portrays. And to see him as more of a zany character with a purpose and intent, I really, really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
And highlight, like, I know you touched on it with just the highlighting of this of the corrupt legal system and just the, you know, taking the temperature of the political realm right now. And it really, depending on, you know, it doesn't matter what side of the, you know, the line you're on, red or blue or whatnot. It's just the corruption that exists and that is really happening here in 1968, and just the way things are twisted and manipulated to favor those that are in power. It was just aggravating. And that's one of the things, you know, that makes film great, is to make you have an emotional response to something. And that's what this did for me, especially.
Agree. All right, Doug, what are your thoughts?
I really enjoyed it. I plan on watching it a few times, actually. But like you guys both said, being kind of where, you know, our, you know, country is right now, it's pretty, I don't know, eye-opening, or I don't know what's the right word, but just like unbelievable that we're kind of back in that kind of situation in a sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
It definitely makes you think back then, you know, obviously what they were fighting for, they were protesting, you know, the Vietnam War and all that stuff. And it's just, it's interesting to see how they were going about it, how they wanted to do it. Obviously I was still too little to remember the riots here in Chicago. But, you know, over the years, studying history and whatever, I have seen plenty of the footage of what went down, you know, during the Democratic Convention. And I felt that the movie did a nice job of telling the story of these guys and kind of what they went through and how they were treated in the legal system. And, you know, it makes you obviously question things, right? But I thought it was very powerful. I thought the acting was fantastic. I think, the seven actors that played the real life folks that went through it did a great job. I thought the dialogue was great. I thought the pacing was great. Obviously, it was written by
Sorkin,
Aaron. Yeah, thank you. Who obviously, you know, what he's done with The West Wing and American President, and, you know, a bunch of other stuff. He's really good at the political realm when it comes to writing and directing. So I was, that sold me alone when I knew he was doing it. I'm like, oh, this is going to be great. And it was. Yeah. I would highly recommend this to everybody to watch it. If anything else, it's a history lesson. You know, you kind of learn what people were going through back then, why they were going through it, how they went through it, and ultimately how they were judged for it. Mm-hmm. And it's a strong story. I enjoyed it.
No, I just, yeah, I'm glad you liked it, Doug, and I'm glad that we were all able to kind of heap praise on this movie, because I think it really does a lot of things very well. Go ahead, Wayne.
Just the aspect of Judge Julius Hoffman, played by Frank Langella.
Langella.
Now, yeah, just obvious his bias, and it seems like he's already made up his mind and his decision about these 8 individuals, especially Bobby Seale. Mm-hmm. Before everything gets started, and to think back on just like the power that he wielded over this trial, and it's noted that the lawyer for the 7, forgive me, I don't remember his name,
Cunsler.
He had 24 counts of attempt against him.
Yeah,
trying to judge to be fair.
Right.
It's just Frank Langella did a fantastic job portraying this judge, and the fact that 78% of Chicago trial lawyers said that he was unfit to rule. It's kind of like this kind of stuff went on, and kind of, you know, is this stuff still going on? It's just stuff that makes you ask questions.
Yeah.
That, I think, really makes an intriguing film, and really, you know, just the substance that leaves you wondering and thinking after the fact.
No, for
sure. Right,
yeah.
And I think that's what makes it, a strong movie, right? It makes you, it's making you think, it's making you question things. And that tells you enough right there, you know, that it was done well.
Yeah, for sure. And I think just to speak more on the movie aspect of this thing, with the Oscars now being pushed back a little bit, but with the limited amount of movies that have come out this year, I think this is going to definitely be on top of the list. You're going to see probably, I would like to see Sacha Baron Cohen or Jeremy Strong, because those are my two favorite performances. And I think, obviously, they had a lot of fun with their characters, Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, the two hippies, who are a lot smarter than I think people gave them credit for back then, which I thought was kind of a fun thing to play with. And I thought those two were terrific, as well as everybody else. But I thought those two specifically stood out for me.
Yeah, and I think one of the most powerful scenes, and I can't remember the names of the characters, but it's when they're, obviously it's at night, they're not in court, and you're seeing two different perspectives on how they think they should fight back. Meaning in court, not at the riots, but in court.
Yes.
And one guy's like, you're going to make us be remembered as these hippies who just smoked dope and were idiots. And then the other guy came right back at him, and he's like, well, you should know better, that this is the way, you know, you have to push back, or whatever it was. I mean, it was a great scene. I thought that was probably one of the most powerful scenes in the whole movie, and it kind of set the tone. Well, it didn't set the tone. It just kind of just gave you a different perspective on, even though all these guys were on trial for this one riot, there was so many more things within there, how each one looked at this revolution, you know, or their cause, or how they wanted to go and push their cause. You know what I mean? I thought it was great. I loved it.
It was great to see the different perspectives that you could have even within the same faction. You know, these people were all there for the same reason, but they all kind of had different thoughts on how it should be handled. And I think when they put Abbie Hoffman on the stand in the courtroom, I thought the back and forth between him and Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character was fantastic. And that scene also stands out for me, but also, yes, the one that you're talking about was mainly between Abbie Hoffman and Tom Hayden, who were kind of the two leaders that you had, one being the hippie going out in the way out in left field, and the other one being the very kind of conservative liberal, if you will, very buttoned up, still wanted to obey the law and stuff, but wanted to still get his point across, and I thought that was that scene was fantastic. I do agree.
It was fantastic, and you know, also the other scene when he stands up and he's the only one to stand up when the judge is leaving.
Yep.
And the other 6 look at him like, "What are you doing?" And he's like, "Oh, you know," he's like,
so good.
It just kind of showed, like you said, he's kind of like in the middle, like
Yeah, it was a great movie. As you could tell, we're obviously recommending this. You could watch it right now on Netflix. We're going to keep moving along here because we went kind of long on the Halloween franchise. So we're going to move right into Gone But Not Forgotten. It's a topic that we do about a celebrity who has passed on. We always talk about the celebrities that have died in recently or died recently. This last week, it was Margaret Nolan, actor and artist, Goldfinger title sequence star. So she was the silhouette in Goldfinger that they used. Joe Morgan, the Hall of Famer, baseball player. And then Conchata Farrell from Two and a Half Men and Mr. Deeds passed away. If you watch Two and a Half Men or you've seen Mr. Deeds, you probably recognize her. She's really funny. She had a heart attack. But this week, we are going to talk about one of Doug's favorite people, I think, of all time, and that is Prince. And Prince left us about 4 years ago, and it was sad, even for me as someone who's not a huge Prince fan. Not that I'm not a fan, I should say. I've just never really kind of focused on him, I guess. But even when he passed away, it still hit me hard because I'm like, wow, that's a big star. That's a big level star. To lose, and he was still young, he was only in his 50s, and it was rough. And Doug, obviously you being a fan, how did that make you feel when that happened?
Wow, I mean, we could do a whole other 2 hour shows right now, buddy, if you got the time. But yeah, it's true. I am a diehard Prince fan. Have all, you know, his albums and, you know, all his B-sides, and, you know, I geek out on him for sure. But to be honest with you, when he passed, it hit me pretty hard, you know, and I don't even know how to really explain it. Like I would see people, like I would hear or see footage of when Elvis died, right? And people would be upset, or John Lennon got shot and people were upset. And I mean, I was like, oh yeah, that's terrible. But I was like devastated, right? Mm-hmm. But then the news came down from Prince, and I can tell you exactly what I was doing, where I was, who I was with, all that stuff. And it did. It hit me hard, you know. And I was like, what? And I couldn't put it into words. I couldn't explain, like, why did it hit me so hard? And a friend of mine told me, she goes, well, because you had a connection with him and his music, and now that's not going to be there anymore. And I thought that was an interesting perspective. She said, it's just, that's really what it is. And I said, huh, okay, you know. So to answer your question, yeah, it was harsh. It was brutal. It took me a little while to just kind of wrap my brain around it. And, you know, because you just never expect it, especially with now that, you know, we're getting older, and, you know, you're seeing some of our heroes pass away, and, you know, David Bowie and, you know, George Michael and all these other artists,
Tom
that,
Petty,
you know, the same year passed away. It's just like Tom Petty. Yeah. Thank you. You know, all these people, Eddie Van Halen just passed away, you know, on the 6th, and that hit me hard, you know, and I'm like, man, all my rock heroes, you know, that I used to look up to are little by little slipping away. So it's just something that, you know, it's part of, you know, part of life. And it's, you know, it's what you got to deal with, I guess.
So in preparation for today, I watched Purple Rain, Doug, probably for the first time all the way through. And during while he was,
hey, I'm proud of you.
Yeah, thank you. While he was performing, we'll talk about the movie and how little it holds up to today. But while he was performing, Rebecca, my wife, she's not even really big into rock and roll music, and she was like, "Wow, like we're not going to have any guitarists left one day." And she's right. I mean, just the people that you talked about, like the great guitarists, we don't. My generation, we don't really, we have a couple, but we don't have the legends that you guys had in that, you know, in Van Halen.
Right.
And even though I'm not a big fan of those, of Van Halen, but I recognize that he was an amazing guitarist. And with Prince, honestly, with Prince, it didn't hit me until the Hall of Fame. When he did the Hall of Fame and he got up on stage and just rocked out for like 30 minutes, I had no idea like how talented he was. You know, aside from a few of his songs, which I will say, When Doves Cry is amazing. I love that song. Purple Rain is also really good.
Yes, it is.
He just never appealed to me, I guess, in any sort of way. Because, again, as you guys know me, I'm not huge into rock and roll as much as I, you know, as a lot of other people are. I have my bands here and there. But it was still interesting, again, like I said, when he passed away, for me to just be like, wow, that, like, I understood how big it was. Now, to talk about Purple Rain a little bit, it's a bit dated. I think everybody knows that with the appearances. It doesn't handle women very well, which was, watching it through a 2020 lens, is like, ooh. Like, we thought it was funny that Jerome came out and picked up a woman and threw her in the dumpster. Like, that was where we were at back then. Like, it was it was kind of a strange moment that I was having watching it now. That being said, it was somewhat, the music makes it enjoyable. And, like, the last, like, 20 minutes, you kind of forget about uh-huh. most of that kind of stuff, and you just enjoy the movie. But, yeah, it's an interesting movie, I don't know if you...
Well, I don't know if how much you know of Purple Rain or why Purple Rain happened, but it's a semi-autobiography on him.
See, and that's... So I looked up, though, like, his parents... It didn't seem like his parents were like that, though. That's what I was confused by.
Well, all right, so a quick history on Prince, okay? you know, he was born in, I think, 56, June of 56. His dad was a very religious, strict man, okay. And his mom was the housewife kind of a thing, and they were musicians, all right? And okay. his father's name was John L. Nelson.
Yeah.
So in Purple Rain, you see him write, his dad's name is Francis L., so they just changed it from John to Francis. So... In the movie, or in the real world, his parents were musicians, and that's where Prince got his gift. Mm. His dad was very strict, though. You know, he was very religious. You know, mm-hmm. he would always speak about the Bible and speak about God and this and that and that. And that's where you get a lot of Prince's spiritual songs, because Prince was very spiritual. I mean, mm-hmm. the song "I Would Die for You" on Purple Rain, go back and listen to it. I urge you. Go read the lyrics. It's all about Jesus Christ. But then you go to Darling Nikki, and he's talking about, you know, people masturbating in a hotel room and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's kind
I
of
heard
where,
that one.
You know,
yeah.
he was like all over the road, right? And, yeah. And so, and the way that happened was because when his parents got divorced, Prince was basically on his own. His mom started dating, his dad moved on. And the way that Prince was exposed to, we'll say, the, you know, to sex and all that stuff, was his mom would leave out pornographic magazines for him to read. You know, she just didn't know how to introduce him to that world, and she knew that dad wasn't going to do anything. So she was just trying to be, I guess, proactive. Mm-hmm. But in a sense, that's why you get these songs with mixed signals and he's all over the road and whatever. So that story, the movie, is loosely based on him. So when you see his parents arguing or his parents not getting along, that some of that's true. When you see Prince, you know, struggling with, you know, coming up with hit songs or trying to be, you know, trying not to get kicked out of that club, because he knows if he gets kicked out of First Avenue, which is a great club in real life, by the way, he knows he's not going to make it. So, you know, it's not, you know, dead on his life, but it's loosely based on his life. So that's why, you know, you're not going to get some of that other stuff you talked about, because they were trying to stay somewhat within his lane of
gotcha.
His life.
Understandable. Okay.
Yeah.
Wayne, do you have any thoughts on Prince?
Yeah, there you go.
My biggest memory of Prince, again, I'm like toward the Kirky aspect of not being a fan. Not that I'm not his and I don't recognize the talent, just that's something that I gravitated towards. But his Super Bowl performance in 2007 is arguably the greatest ones of all time. And, you know, you see, especially lately, we've seen some pretty lackluster performances during the Super Bowl. In 2007, I think that performance not only was the greatest in Super Bowl history, but one of the best live performances I've ever seen. Well, just, you know, on TV, but still seeing it as it happened.
Yeah.
In the rain, didn't matter. He's out there just spreading it, and just one of my fondest memories. Also, the music that he did for the first Batman movie.
Yep, the Bat mm-hmm. Dance.
Just fantastic stuff. That's where I am drawn.
And I think, and that's why I kind of wanted
great album.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to talk to him too. Obviously, Doug, I know that you're a big fan, so it would be easy for you to talk about him. But the other thing I wanted to draw into was his influence over Hollywood. And the influence that a movie like Purple Rain had over other movies about rock stars, where they would kind of follow that formula almost to a T up until now. Like, that's even like with biopics, like it almost follows the exact same formula. So obviously they were tapping into something there, I think, that a lot of artists go through. And it was interesting to see him early in his career get that movie off the ground.
Yeah. Yeah. He had a lot of, clout over Warner Brothers. For whatever reason, I mean, I don't know. Again, I don't want to get too much into his history, but, you know, Prince was he was a music protege. I mean, he was a gifted child. He knew 27 instruments before he was, like, you know, in his 20s.
Yeah.
His first album, he produced, wrote, like, he did everything on his first album. Mm-hmm. And Warner Brothers was like, I don't know about this. They sent an executive. They listened to him. They watched him mix it in the studio, and they said, okay, this kid's got it. He can do it. And so from that moment on, from 77, 78, fast forward to 84, when Purple Rain started coming together or was released, and he had, you know, written a script with some other people and getting the soundtrack ready, he had a lot of clout. Warner Brothers believed in this kid because he's like, well, this kid's a genius, you know, let him run with it. And that's why, you know, he was able to do some of this stuff. You know, obviously things change as his career goes on. But yeah, a lot of things, one thing that people don't really know about him is that if you look at any of his albums, he did everything. He wrote it, produced it, composed it, and he basically played most of the instruments on the albums. He had his bands, so like The Revolution.
Well, for touring and stuff, right? Yeah.
They did come into the studio, but a lot of times he would work 10, 15, 20 hours through the night, and he would come back and play this mix for them, go, okay, this is what I want. And they're like, okay. And then they would, you know, lay it down on tape in the studio. It's amazing. It's amazing what this guy really, really did for music and Hollywood.
Yeah, see, and it kind of sucks, like, for someone like me kind of realizing this all after the fact that he's already gone. So I guess that's what it was. Like, I just didn't have this.
Well, and I think that's just...
Go ahead.
Yeah. No, and this is why it's great to have these conversations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you bringing people on your shows and talking about these kind of folks. And hopefully someone listening out there today is going to go, well, let me check out this Prince guy. Let me see what he's all about. And, you know, just keep educating people, because you're right. I mean, I feel for like your generation, where I don't feel like you have some of these, you know, rock gods or rock stars or whatever that's gonna, you know, stand the test of time. I just don't see it.
Yeah.
Maybe that'll change, but
it might, you know? as they all get older. That's the thing, is like, they still got to get older, right? So once that happens, exactly. maybe they will.
Yeah.
All right. Well, rest in peace to Prince, wherever he is. We miss his talent and his music. And we'll be moving on to segment 4, our final segment, which is where we talk about things that we've watched, anything we want to recommend to people. Doug, I'm going to go first, and then Wayne, and then Doug, you can feel free to mention anything to anybody, and then we'll wrap up here. I'm going to talk about very little, just kind of the stuff I watched this week through my 31 Days of Halloween, which honestly was mostly taken up by the Halloween franchise, so... I'll go through my list real quick, because I had that. So, 31 Days of Halloween this year, I've been watching Ready or Not, 12-Hour Shift, Day of the Dead, Vampires vs. the Bronx, Don't Breathe, The Shed, Cherry Falls, Valentine, The Lie, and The Raven. So, starting off this week, after last week's podcast, I watched Saw 2, Halloween 2, Halloween 4, H2O, and the Halloween 2018. But then I also watched some Amazon Prime originals from Blumhouse. And that's where I'm going to talk about mostly today. If you've seen Saw 2, then you know. If you like the Saw franchise, watch it. I don't really need to talk about it. It's been out for a while. Black Box, directed by Emmanuel Osei Kufur, starring Mamoudou Athi. It is a movie about this guy who, as we meet him, he's just like woken up from a coma. And he has memory loss, and he's trying to figure out, like, what happened and kind of get back to himself. There's definitely some supernatural elements into it. It's part of Blumhouse's 4 movies they released to Amazon within the last 2 weeks. I really liked this one. Last week, I talked about the movie The Lie. I hated it. It was awful. This one I thought was really good. I definitely recommend it if you haven't seen it. It's on Amazon Prime. And then there is Nocturne, which is another one. It's about a musical prodigy, also from Blumhouse. On Amazon Prime, it's okay. It's very similar to like a Black Swan or The Perfection, which is a Netflix original movie, which I really liked. This one, the ending could have been better, but it was pretty cool. Very supernatural. She finds like a music book, and it starts like speaking to her almost, and things start to happen, and it's very crazy. Decent movie. Check it out. But that's basically all I have for this week, because I was catching up on or watching some Halloween movies to kind of get my mind right for this episode. Wayne, what do you got for us?
I am very, very excited that Dexter is getting brought back to life. And I hope and pray that they do it correctly, because there are times when Dexter is fantastic. And there are times when Dexter was, what the hell are they thinking? So Michael C. Hall is coming back for a limited release.
Yes.
I don't remember exactly all the details, but I am so very excited to see where this goes, because it needs to have some redemption, in my opinion.
I think it's going to be, like, it's already being called, like, the final 10 episodes, so we'll see. Obviously, if it does well, they'll probably do more, but hopefully they give it a really good ending.
Right. As far as stuff that I've watched this week, I'm working my way through Sons of Anarchy again. More or less, it's just kind of on and background stuff when I'm doing other things, but obviously, as I've said before, I think that it is one of my top 10 shows of all time. Fantastic show. Yeah, that's about it. I haven't really watched too much right now, but my main focus is that Dexter is coming back for some redemption. I'm still very excited about that.
All right, Doug, do you have anything?
Nice, nice. Good for you. Yeah, the one thing that I've watched, and I enjoyed it, maybe you guys talked about it already. If you have, I apologize, but, Ratched on Netflix. Have you guys seen this?
I have not finished it yet, but I like what I've seen so far.
Okay, then I won't blow the whole thing. But, so Ratched, if you guys like American Horror Story, this is right up your alley. It's set in the, 40s. Sarah Paulson stars in it as Nurse Mildred Ratched. And basically, she's a nurse who infiltrates this hospital and has I don't know if it's an actual, it's almost like, now that I think about it, it's almost like Halloween, where it's a brother
a foster brother.
Foster brother.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Foster brother. Right. Foster brother. And she goes in there and she's basically trying to help save him. But then you learn their backstory, which is pretty dark, and then you learn more about the brother and can he be saved, can he not, and then you learn more about Nurse Ratched, like what her real intentions are. And it's well written, it's a lot of fun, it's freaky, like I said. Mm-hmm. If you like American Horror, it's got that kind of vibe, not as dark as American Horror, but like that kind of, like, the dialogue, the mm-hmm. monotone kind of body language, the, you know, that kind of stuff. I really enjoyed it. I saw the first episode and I'm like, oh yeah, this is going to be great. And, I zipped through it and I'll probably watch it again. It was great. And I love that it was set in the 40s. So the costumes and the sets are beautifully shot. It's great. It's a great, great story.
Good. Good. All right. So we're going to go on to our very last part. This is still the same segment here, but it's news from this week. Wayne already touched on the Dexter revival, but we have Mad Max Furiosa prequel with Anya Taylor-Joy, Chris Hemsworth, and Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, who was in The Trial of the Chicago 7. That's in the works right now. It's official. Kristen Ritter is going to star in a Night Books adaptation for Netflix from the Brightburn director. Day of the Dead series coming to Sci-Fi from Stephen Kostansky, who directed the movie The Void, Leprechaun Returns, and the upcoming Psycho Gorman. I Know What You Did Last Summer TV series heading to Amazon. This is one thing I wanted to talk about. Adam McKay has a new movie. He did The Big Short and obviously Anchorman and a bunch of Will Ferrell movies, but he also did Vice. His new movie is set up at Netflix. It's called Don't Look Up. It stars, listen to this cast, guys, Jennifer Lawrence, Leonardo DiCaprio, Meryl Streep, Cate Blanchett, Timothy Chalamet, Jonah Hill, Himesh Patel, Rob Morgan, Matthew Perry, Ariana Grande, Kid Cudi, and Tomer Sisley. That's a huge cast.
Holy cow.
I'm excited for this
movie. What's the budget on this one?
Jeez. I have no idea. A lot.
Wow. So, that's a heavy set.
Yeah, it's going to Netflix. It's about the end of the world and two astronauts, I believe played by Jennifer Lawrence and Leonardo DiCaprio, or maybe Timothy Chalamet, who have to go around and, like, do media interviews to, like, kind of ease everybody else's, like, panic. And like, oh, no, it's going to be okay. So it's a comedy, obviously. I'm sure with McKay's recent work, there'll be some political tie-ins and stuff. But that cast is just ridiculous. Fried Green Tomatoes TV series from Norman Lear and NBC starring Reba McEntire on the way. Buck Rogers movie in development at Legendary. Movies coming out. Coming to America 2 is the newest big-budget movie to make the move to streaming. It'll hit Amazon Prime. If you have Amazon Prime Video, it'll be free December 18th. $125 million that they spent on this movie. Hillbilly Elegies, directed by Ron Howard, starring Amy Adams and Glenn Close, hits Netflix November 24th. The Lego Star Wars Holiday Special, streaming on Disney Plus November 17th. And then there's a new Alan Ball film called Uncle Frank, starring Paul Bettany, which hits Amazon Prime on Thanksgiving. A huge Alan Ball fan. I liked American Beauty. He also did True Blood and 6 Feet Under on HBO. So that looks pretty interesting. And that's all I got for this week. We want to thank everybody for listening. Doug, thank you so much for coming on. It was a lot of fun to talk to you about the Halloween franchise. We look forward to having you on again, and good luck on your podcast.
Yeah, thanks, guys. This was a lot of fun. It was just great going down memory lane with all the Halloween stuff. But again, I can't say it enough. I'm proud of you two guys. You guys are doing great. I really enjoyed what you guys are doing with the movie podcast. Keep it going. Keep us entertained and keep us informed on everything that's coming out. You guys are doing great.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Doug. We appreciate the kind words. To everybody else, have a great week, and thank you.